San Jose Avenue.
From our 901 Mission Street studios, you are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle.
Welcome to the big event. Welcome, Carolyn Zinko. Welcome to the intro.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited you're here. Lifestyle writer. I've worked with you. We've co-bylined pieces together. I've always enjoyed your work. And now you're working for Green State, too, writing cannabis pieces. I wanted to ask you, what would 15-year-old Carolyn Zinko say to the current Carolyn Zinko about someday getting paid to write about weed?
Carolyn Zinko, when she was 15, was very shy, and she would have been amazed and shocked and stunned that she could get paid to write about cannabis, because cannabis today is as acceptable as having a glass of wine.
I wanted to get you on, though, because lifestyle writer, you write about society, the dress down with Tony Bravo. I see you on Facebook Live. You also rock. You rock hard. I knew this before, but you interviewed Bruce Dickinson recently of Iron Maiden. We talked a lot about that. And today for San Francisco Music Greatest of All Time, the first episode, we are inducting And Justice for All from Metallica in our Hall of Fame. How do you feel about that?
I think it's a great idea, and I think all headbangers out there are going to agree with us.
Okay, so we're going to rock. You and me, Aydin Viziri is coming in. It's Metallica Day on the big event. Let's rock! Welcome to the big event, Aydin Viziri and Carolyn Zinko. We're here. Are you with me for And Justice for All, Metallica?
Yeah.
If you could see us, we're making devil horns
with our
fingers. We're
making devil horns. So Aydin, pop music critic, and Carolyn, style czar, except you've switched your jobs a little bit, and I'm going to work this into Metallica somehow. You are now our cannabis reporter?
Yes, we have, for the last year, had a cannabis website called greenstate.com because we're all in a green state of mind.
Yeah.
And I've been asked to help out with writing feature stories for it about sleep and wellness and even sexuality. So it's been really a lot of fun the last couple of months.
I am digging Green State because I am someone who didn't smoke pot or barely smoked it for like 25 years. I smoked right up to college and then stopped. And then I got my card. Chronicle paid for it. They did a story, and I got to get my card, and I started smoking again. And I was like, it was like blowing me away. Like, I got scared. So I love Green State because it really talks me through it.
It's demystifying a lot
of
things.
It's demystifying a lot of things. It's a good explainer if you're someone like me who like is like, okay, so it's legal now. Now what?
Yeah, you what know? Is THC? What is CBD? How can I use it without getting super baked, super high? You can use it medicinally in tiny doses to take the edge off.
But Metallica, though. So we're going to work this into Metallica. Carolyn, you know, as our expert here, is Metallica, is it like an indica or a sativa band? Can you match? We're talking about Injustice for All today.
Yeah.
Is there any?
I'm going to go with definitely with sativa with a little bit of meth.
Okay. I don't think that's
it's definitely
legal yet.
Definitely no, but it's not an indica. It's not for sitting there, you know, trapped in your couch. It's super energetic and it's thrashing, and I cannot imagine indica being used to describe Metallica.
Meth and Metallica do kind of go hand in hand. I don't know why, but they do.
We don't officially endorse that, but
no.
Let's just
I don't think the band
the
would either, but you know, it's just it's so driving like a train, you know. It's like it's too energetic for indica.
Yeah. I personally selfishly wanted to start this series SF Music Greatest of All Time inducting And Justice for All in our little Hall of Fame. And I'm going to lay down a little bit of history in a little bit, but I wanted you guys to share maybe your first Metallica introduction, and if you remember your first And Justice for All introduction, where you might have listened to it, what kind of effect it might have had.
I have kind of a funny Metallica story in that growing up, you know, my friends and I would borrow each other's tapes and listen to, you know, just to try different things out. And I remember there was a Metallica tape getting passed around, and I think it was Injustice for All. And it got into the hands of one of our friends who, you know, put the piece of tape over that little hole on top where so you can record over it. And he had recorded it in his best James Hetfield / satanic voice. Get out of the room. So he's like, one night he like came over and he's like, dude, this, I think this is possessed. And, you know, this was the era where like the satanic imagery was very heavy in heavy metal. And like you actually believed Ozzy Osbourne worshiped the devil. So, you know, he's like, I think this tape is possessed. He put it on. I heard that demonic voice and I ran out of the house and like thought like Metallica was just evil. But I came around a few years later. But that was kind of my introduction to Metallica.
That's funny. I was trying really hard to think about this because I became aware of them in college at the University of Wisconsin at Madison because I am a Badger and a Wisconsinite. And my first memory of them really is the Master of Puppets album. And my roommate and I, her name was Anne, were like there were very few female metalheads in our dorm. We were like the two resident metalhead chicks. And we just played that thing over and over and over and over. And it just, I was listening to Dio and Wasp and Kiss and Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Scorpions, Michael Schenker, all that stuff back then. And it just was so different because it was so much faster and hard charging. And we just seemed, it just seemed like the coolest thing.
Yeah, I remember specifically getting a tape, and it was, I think, Master of Puppets from someone I worked with, and it was a dupe of a dupe of a dupe of a dupe. And I put it in my crappy Chevy Nova car stereo, and it just didn't sound like anything. I mean, there was no accessibility to it because it just sounded like white noise. And then probably a year or two later, I'm at a party. Wealthy friend in Hillsboro, and all the girls are playing like Depeche Mode and stuff. And somebody's brother puts on And Justice for All, which had just come out. All of a sudden, I heard one and heard the kind of melodic, you know, Kirk Hammett doing more of the classical thing, and then the build and the build and the build. And at the point where it got to the, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Darkness imprisoning me. All that I see, absolute horror. I cannot live, I cannot die. Trapped to myself, body my holding cell. Ah! Oh my God, it just grabbed me. And I was like this kid who, you know, I was like a Led Zeppelin fan. I was always looking for something through the filter of, does it sound like Led Zeppelin? Maybe I was a little bit into Van Halen. And this was something different, but it was like in movement. So it, all the people who had told me like this metal and this hard rock is not real music, I'm like, this is like a built like a Mozart song. I mean, it's in movements and there's tempo changes. And I went out and bought it, you know, the next day, the next week, the next time I had enough money to go to Tower Records, and just got sucked in. And it changed the way I looked at music, because I was stuck in this kind of Led Zeppelin rut, you know, and Led Zeppelin's a great band, but I was sort of just not venturing beyond that.
Thing is, like 1988, when the album came out, was an insane year for music, because after a long period of like, you know, Thompson Twins and Poison and like Howard Jones, like this really kind of middling stuff, you suddenly got Public Enemy, NWA, Metallica with this album, Sonic Youth, the Pixies, like it was just.
Wasn't that also when Guns N' Roses were having
Guns N' Roses? Yeah, that was when they released Lies. So it was just, music got really good that year. I don't know what it was, you know, something happened and
something in the air.
A lot of great albums came out. So
I think the music history, people talk a lot like there were the hair metal bands and then grunge killed them. But I think you're picking up on something, that there was something in between that, and there was a lot of good stuff in between that and experimentation and great things. I looked through the Chronicle, and Very first Metallica appearance. It was before Cliff Burton was involved. I don't even know. I mean, it might have been the Dave Mustaine year. It was Metallica from L.A. playing at the old Waldorf. But I think Metallica agrees that the first show of, you know, the real Metallica was at the Stone. And I have it here. I have the Chronicle listing. Saturday, March 5th, 1983. Metallica with Laz Rocket, 9 p.m. at the Stone. $4 at 412 Broadway. And that was the show that I think there's actually audio of it somewhere. That's the very first show with Cliff Burton. And I think that kind of established them as, you know, that's the beginning of the San Francisco years. Carolyn, did you have a story about that exact concert?
Well, so my husband, Dan, who says he was at that show, remembers being at that show, said that he went to see Bitch Armored Saint in a local band, and one of the bands dropped out and Metallica filled in. He felt like it just changed everything because of the fast songs and people started jumping around and a mosh pit formed. And he is a big mosh pit fan. In fact, even just last year at age 60, he got injured in a mosh pit. The energy never dies, or the interest never dies. But he just remembered it just blew him away.
I found some old interviews. Lars Ulrich was telling the Chronicle that they said, we're crossing over to so many different people. In the beginning, only hardcore punks would come. Now it's normal kids from the suburbs of Iowa. And I think that leads up to And Justice for All, which is almost like an extreme reaction in that direction. I look in the Chronicle, and at the time, Metallica is like opening for Day on the Green. There's one article where Sammy Hagar actually comes out and says, yeah, you know, we got these other bands, Dokken, Metallica's there, and you'll have little clusters of people that are there for them, but then when we come on, when this is the OU812, when we come on, they all come for us, you know? So, I mean, I'm thinking that Metallica's probably feeling a little bit like the underdogs. And even though Master of Puppets was such a huge success, it's like they doubled and tripled down and on And Justice for All, which is an album that has longer songs, more time changes, longer, more complex solos, at times speeds up. At one point in Harvester of Sorrow, they actually like grind to a complete halt. And it's like they're stopping and waiting for a car to pass by, and then all of a sudden the guitar kicks up again and they start again. And I feel almost like, you guys listen to the album, I feel like this was a response to something.
It feels like it was a culmination of Metallica's early years. Like really the first phase of the band came together on that album, where they were doing the hard, the heavy, and like those really technical, the technical musicianship. Because after that, they might as well have turned into R.E.M. or, you know, that's an extreme example, but they totally went commercial and the songs became more generic and, you know, they became kind of this more mainstream band. But with this album, they were just like throwing it all at the wall, just going for it.
I was trying to think about the types of music that the other metal bands were playing at that time, and a lot of them were really into the whole kind of gothic thing, and they had gimmicky things like Iron Maiden had their Eddie, and Van Halen had their spandex, and the David Lee Roth's long hair. And to me, one of the things that they kind of departed from with And Justice for All was the whole like anthemic thing, where you could sing along and shake your fist in the air like when you do with Judas Priest or something, right? And because it was almost to me like they were going like a startup, like we've done this, we've cracked into it, how can we be totally different and more interesting for ourselves, but also not gimmicky and not caving into commercial pressure. and they just looked so normal and ordinary. They didn't have big hair. They didn't have fancy clothes. They didn't have splashy clothes, right? They just looked like guys in a garage playing. And I think that the whole technical thing with pushing their musicianship and their compositions into that direction was just a really, probably a way to keep it interesting for them and interesting for fans and just give people something completely different.
You hit it on, I'm reading right now, Joel Selvin's review from December 12th, 1988, which was 4 months after the album came out, their first concert at the Cow Palace now. So they're big enough to play the Cow Palace. And Joel closes with, low on spectacle and trend consciousness, heavy on raw energy and brutal mass musicality, Metallica gives a solid helping of the band's unique artistic visions. The years of grassroots appeal clearly have paid off, allowing Metallica to reach a broad teenage audience without compromising the basic essence of what the band does. Dean, you've listened to the album again in the last 24 hours as required by SF Music Greatest of All Time. What are some things that jumped out to you on the positive side? We'll talk about some criticisms too.
But. Well, it was that punk spirit that we're talking about and the fact that they really stood out from all the other metal that was happening at the time. They were underdogs and they were scrappy and they were messy and they were noisy. And I mean, that's the appeal of it, isn't it? This was when MTV was just, you couldn't get away from it, and it was the hair metal bands, and everything was polished, and even Guns N' Roses were slick in their own way, and these guys looked like kids who'd been playing in the dirt who just picked up their guitars and started, like, you know, going for it, and they're amazing musicians on top of it, you know, and I know we'll talk about this later, but they just lost one of their members, Cliff Burton died, so they were kind of trying to process that, and being only 22 years old, like, how do you deal with something like that? You just plug in your guitar and play really loud, and you know, all that, I think all that is at play, and that's what makes the album really stand up.
So starts with Blackened, which I think the three songs that I like the most on this album, that one and Harvester of Sorrow kind of perform they work as a trio for me. They don't play a lot of these songs in concert. I've gone to concerts where, you know, half of Ride the Lightning or half of Master of Puppets has been played. But I even read that that after they played And Justice for All, the song once, which is the second song on the album, which is like a 9-minute, you know, just twisting, turning, you know, epic, that Kirk Hammett was like, we can't play that again. I mean, it just kind of brought the crowd to a standstill, and I don't know that they've played it more than a couple times since. I don't feel like I need to hear And Justice for All more than maybe three times in my life. You know, I respect it, but...
Do you think it's one of their best albums?
No, I'm talking about the song.
Oh, I see.
The song.
See. Yeah.
Yeah, the song And Justice for All. There are a few songs on this that I tend to work around.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
But I think part of the appeal of it, aside from the very different approach to song structure, was the severe skepticism about authority figures and institutions. Mm-hmm. And I reached out on Facebook Messenger to a friend of mine who is, we've not deleted our Facebook accounts, mm-hmm. Sean Pickley, who I went to college with at Madison, and he lives on the East Coast. He said he kind of felt, and I feel like this too, that, you know, they combined a lot of the punk and heavy metal elements together, and it has a lot of male fury. And it's kind of, he said, it's unsexy but not sexless, because the male fury has a magnetism of its own. But nobody really listens to Metallica for the... to learn about attraction and seduction. And I think in particular that album, because it was kind of so radically different, just kind of punched a hole in what you would expect from them and their type of heavy metal.
I think you're picking up on something, too. I mean, so many more of these songs are about something, and one was really their breakthrough. They had an MTV video that was really popular, but it was like a seven-minute-long MTV video, which, you know, I hadn't seen before. I didn't remember, except for the Michael Jackson ones, that half of it wasn't the song. It's not that much different than For Whom the Bell Tolls. I mean, the structure and everything, except it's about something. It's about a soldier that's dying, and there's it's a song about war.
Isn't that also when all the Vietnam movies were coming out, like Platoon and Metal Jacket and all that? So it kind of all worked together.
Yeah, and I think I read that they watched CNN and derived some ideas for a lot of their songs from watching the news about the things that are happening in the culture.
Yeah. And you mentioned the unsexiness of the whole thing. That was the major difference is if you went to, you know, let's say Guns N' Roses show, it was a pretty even mix of girls and guys in the audience. But if you go to a Metallica show, it's like,
right.
It's 99% dudes, you know? So,
well, I think the same would probably happen at Exodus or Testament too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was kind of the Metallica and the bands like that, they served as this outlet for all this testosterone these guys had, you know?
I'm going to talk about it. I found some 1991 photos of Metallica at Day on the Green, right before or right after the Black Album came out. And we have a lot of crowd shots. And it's really interesting because there are a couple women, like it's like one in 25 because it's at the front of the crowd. And I want to like track them down now and just give them some kind of citation or medal, or Metallica should give them something, because there are these women in the front row just going for it. And probably I'm imagining it's a hard path to get to the front row in 1991 at a Metallica concert for anyone. But flaws. The production is, I mean, that's something that comes up
constantly.
And then they ended up with Scott Thompson mixing the album and produced by Fleming Rasmussen. But all accounts from the people who were there were that Metallica did what they wanted. And as a result, it's, how would you describe it? There's no bass. Let's start with that.
That's the main thing. You ask anyone about this album, they'll comment on how the band just buried Jason Newsted's bass. And it's funny, like the producer blames the mixers and the mixers blame the band. So it's like this.
Yeah, somebody said somewhere online that they put the mics really close to the drums and the instruments, and they didn't have any getting sort of ambient sound from the rest of the room.
I mean, they were like 22 years old. Cliff Burton dies. This new guy comes in. He's got all this material to learn, and everybody says that he was hazed. I mean, he was not. It was like a bunch of kids in college. Yeah. So
they completely just harassed him and mistreated him. And he said, I was reading a recent interview with him where he said he didn't sleep for the first 3 months he was in Metallica just because he didn't know what those guys were going to do to him. So it makes sense that it spilled over into the recording. I think they just didn't know what to do with him and kind of mixed him out of the whole thing.
30th anniversary of the album, though, they are remastering it, but they're not remixing it. And the mixer says that the what's left of the tapes is probably not usable anyway. But I mean, they're going to put out a new And Justice for All, but it's not going to be an And Justice for All with, you know,
restored bass lines.
We're not going to get that. Maybe the 50th anniversary.
If you go on YouTube, though, there are versions of the album with bass lines on it.
Do you recognize the song?
I don't know. Some of them are better, you know, but fans have gone in and put bass, you know, what should have been on the songs in the first place back.
Wow, that's dedication.
Yes.
I'm sure they're all bassists.
It's yeah, exactly.
Some Kind of Monster. That's another just added thing that to me improves in some ways and explains in other ways and maybe adds a few flaws, but all of their work before it. This is the Saint Anger documentary before they're making Saint Anger, and Metallica, for whatever reason, let a documentarian follow them basically in their therapy sessions as they're trying to get along and hash out all of this stuff in the history of the band. And Ideen, have you seen it? And
many times, yes. I don't know what they were thinking making it. It was a great way to learn how dysfunctional the band is. And it's a miracle they've lasted this long, really, because they're really messed up. And I have no idea why they made that movie. but that's you can say that about a lot of things Metallica has done. It's like, why did they do that? As a fan, it must be really frustrating and perplexing because they've just gone off and you want them to stay in this one lane, and they've done some things that have really tested the boundaries of tested the patience of their fans. But they can still, headline AT&T Park and pack it. Yeah.
They're struggling to do the right thing constantly and sometimes failing. And I think some kind of monster, even though it came out years later, to me explains a lot of things that I was confused about with Injustice for All, the album.
Was it cathartic for them to do that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a great documentary. If I were to hand someone five rock documentaries, that would be one of them. I don't know. I don't know if they thought they were going to look good. Maybe they still think they looked good. But a good documentary is not about looking good. It's about, dissecting something, and that's what they did. And maybe they like that part of it too,
I will say this about Metallica, having spent a lot of time with each of the members together and individually, they all have great senses of humor about themselves and the band. So they're willing to laugh at things like that. And they're all really sweet guys. I mean, they're just really sweet, genuine, vulnerable guys. I don't know about James Hetfield because he's the one that I haven't spent much time with, but yeah. Lars and Kirk and Robert, they're all just like the sweetest guys. There's no other way to describe it.
Well, I think we've all run into them, certainly in society circles.
I ran into Lars at a party at the De Young 1 year, and that's when he was with Connie Nielsen, and my husband was with me. And he was very kind about, chatting with us for like 2 minutes. It's like giving the husband the elbow, like, let's not bug him too much. I'm sure he's never wanted, fans have never wanted to talk to him before. So I wanted to make sure we didn't overstay our welcome, but he was really, really gracious. And then there was a book release party for Kirk's horror novel about his horror collection. And there was at a nightclub near the Armory, excuse me, and super sweet, super nice guy. Couldn't have been nicer.
Yeah.
Very smiley, genuine, not egotistical, just like not what you would think of somebody who belongs in one of the greatest bands of all time.
And we should say that, I mean, we all meet a lot of people who are famous, and, I've gotten over the meeting my heroes thing. I mean, I just brace myself for the worst. And I met Metallica on, I had 5 or 6 minutes on a red carpet. It was the first time, and I talked to three of them. And same thing. I mean, they were, like, engaged. And that's the thing that surprised me. And, I mean, a lot of people are cordial. It's pretty rare that someone's flat-out rude to me. But usually they're distant, and you feel like they're reading the Miranda rights to you. And
actors, sometimes find to be a little bit distant.
Yeah, I mean, and they were like engaged, like every question I asked was a good question. I don't think it was fake. I think, we just recently did a horror movie right up for the Pink section, and there was nothing to promote. No album out. They weren't on tour. It's usually hard to get a hold of anybody of their caliber or even less. And on a spot notice when they're not promoting something. And Ideen, you called, did you call him directly? Kirk Hammett gives this great interview to us just to.
Not only was he willing to do it, but he was so excited about it and like gave me. They'll usually be like, oh, you have 15 minutes on this. He gave me as much time as I needed, and he's telling me really personal stories. And sending files over. I mean, they're just so approachable. And
that's because it's his hobby and it's a, like his passion outside of music. So
well, there's that.
Horror movie memorabilia collection.
Also, I think, you know, they're a Bay Area band. And I think growing up here and spending your formative years here, you have a different sensibility than a band that comes up through L.A. or New York, and you just kind of keep your feet on the ground. I find that to be true with a lot of native Bay Area bands.
Yeah, but I find it, I mean, you know more, but I find it more with the older bands. Like Neil Sean will, you know, give you his phone number, but that's because he was from that old school where he and Joel Selvin were crossing paths a lot more than we cross paths with Green Day. And I think Metallica kind of, in some ways, still represents that or respects it.
For sure, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of Neil Sean, remember, he let me cover his wedding.
Yeah.
That's pretty, they are pretty open, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to tell you about some photos I discovered. Sorry, I'm just going to promote my thing. I found 1991 Day on the Green photos. I told you already about the crowd, but we have photos of them in it, and the photographer took photos while Kirk Hammett's coming on stage and high-fiving. So I'm going to put those on my latest RSF. They'll be on www.sfchronicle.com. We've got about 15 photos, color photos from 1991, which usually we shot in black and white, and lots of photos of the band and the crowd. That's what I love, because you can find photos of the band from 1991, and probably every concert looks the same, but this is a Day on the Green crowd. So those will be on sfchronicle.com. With Bay Area bands, where does Metallica fit in? Are they one of the best? Are they in their own category? Are they? Do you think of them that way?
They are among the top 10, if not top 5. You know, you got, when you identify Bay Area music, that's, Metallica really stands out. You know, you got the bands from the 60s like Sly and the Family Stone and the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane, but beyond that, you know, I think between Metallica and Green Day, they're the most important Bay Area bands. You know, maybe the last most important Bay Area bands that we've had.
Well, I was thinking about some of the, in that genre, I was thinking about Exodus and Testament. I worked at Tower Records, and I remembered Faith No More, YNT. I mean, for me, in, you know, metal, they are obviously the pinnacle. They're the top.
Mm-hmm.
They're the Tower of Pisa. They're, you know, hands down.
Yeah, beyond the Bay Area, I mean, they're one of the most important American bands, especially in that genre.
Well, I got a couple other pieces of trivia. And Justice for All was nominated for the first Best Hard Rock Metal Performance, but they did not win. It went to, do you know this one?
Jethro Tull.
Oh,
for Crest of a Knave. And at the time, Bay Area resident Bobby McFerrin was the big winner of the night, winning 3 Grammys. So that had to fuel them to do greater things. And then they did make up for it, though, a couple months later, and Justice for All won a BAMMY, beating out Neil Young's This Note for You and Huey Lewis in the News' Perfect World for Best Album. So
Great.
I thought that was nice.
Yeah. So especially since I don't remember those other two albums.
So, Ideen, next time you talk to one of the band members, make sure you ask them where they keep their BAMMY.
Yes,
exactly. From 1992. And final thoughts.
It was the album that made the band. It's the album that kind of lifted them up out of this scene where they were playing alongside the Exoduses and the Testaments of the world, and they became Metallica, you know, the same way U2 is U2 and Madonna is Madonna. It set them up for the Black Album and becoming the band that can still play stadiums, what is it, 30 years later now? Yeah.
Carolyn.
I don't know how I can top that. Well, yeah. Said.
I think that as much as I like the album itself, it's hard for me to separate it from being that point where I realized that the music I was listening to had value and had musical value, and it wasn't just – the stoner music, and it wasn't just that I liked to listen to hard rock because I was an aggressive person, that this was music in the same way that, you know, classical music is music and great jazz is music. And I kind of embrace that. And that's how I remember And Justice for All. I listen to it now. I enjoy it. I hear the lack of the bass, but it brings back a pretty warm feeling to me, and that it was kind of a musical awakening. And I realize that could have happened with a lot of different albums, depending on what I heard when. But, you know, maybe if I had heard Public Enemy a month later, that might have been the album that did that. But this was the one for me, and I'm always going to think of it that way. Nice. So, yeah. And Justice for All. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Both of you.
This was fun.
Yeah, hey, Dean. And yeah, go.
Can I bring it back to cannabis since we started with that?
That is fantastic. I would love for you to bring it back to cannabis.
Okay. So I was just remembering something else that the husband said last night at his first show at the Stone, seeing Metallica. After the show, Dave Mustaine was out front. They were, I guess, these guys loaded their own gear.
Yeah, yeah.
So Dave Mustaine was out front. Dan was out front. His friends that he was seeing the show were out front. And this old guy named Jimmy, some grizzled looking guy. And everyone said, hey, you want to get high? So they're like, yeah, okay. So they pulled out some cannabis pot back then. Reefer, not cannabis today. And they all fired up, right? And they got high together. And as it turns out, Jimmy wasn't Jimmy. It was Jerry Garcia.
Wow. That is fantastic. That is a great story. I wish we could end every podcast with a story that good.
Well, we should start calling it podcast then.
Podcast.
I'm definitely going to start calling him Jimmy Garcia, though.
Well, thank you very much to both of you. I really appreciate you coming on. SF Music, Greatest of All Time, and Justice for All, Metallica, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
You are listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you to my guests, Carolyn Zinko and Ideen Vaziri. Executive producer is Fernando Diaz, and our editor-in-chief is Audrey Cooper. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community. Subscribe to the Chronicle. See my Day on the Green Metallica column and photos, www.sfchronicle.com. San Francisco Chronicle podcasts are on iTunes and other streaming services. Listen at www.sfchronicle.com/podcasts with an S.